goodness.
The House Transportation and Regional Governance Committee will come to order. And we do have a quorum. Let's see. Who would like to? President Carlson, we'll just kind of switch back and forth. How about it? Have a motion to approve the minutes?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. It's my privilege to move the minutes from, what are we looking at here? January 30th of 2017? No. Is that right?
January 30th, yes. 2017, right. All right. Representative Carlson moves approval of the minutes from the January 30th meeting. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and the minutes of the January 30th meeting are approved. Okay, thank you. So we're going to pick up where we left off a couple days ago. And so it's a Met Council day on the Hill again.
Again.
And we have three different topics. So, and in my recollection, at least in the years I've been on sort of this beat, haven't really heard any presentation on SAC or Metro Mobility, you know, in depth. So this will be very interesting.
Great.
So thanks, Mr. Shetton, for being here, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetton. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Met Council, and as always, we appreciate the opportunity to come and speak about the Met Council and the different divisions within our council enterprise. And so today we'll start with the kind of an overview about what the sewer availability charge is. Sounds like we're going to move next into the overview of Metro Mobility, which we were planning to do last week and got moved back, so that's great. And then we'll follow up with our review of the Thrive program. So with that, I've got Ned Smith with me today from our from Metropolitan Council Environmental Services, and he can speak specifically to what SAC is and how what it really means here as far as what it means to us at the Met Council and what it means to the, I guess, development of the region. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Smith, and we'll start for you.
Very good. Welcome, Mr. Smith. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ned Smith, and I am the Director of Finance and Revenue for Met Council Environmental Services, and I do oversee the SAC program. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here and to speak with you today about the critical components supporting development and growth in the region. I have one slide.
There you go.
So I want to start with what is SAC. SAC allows development to occur and make certain that capacity is ready to serve anywhere in the region. It is a one-time wholesale fee charged to local governments based on the capacity demand of a specific user. Local governments have the option of paying out of their own general funds, passing the fee on to the end user as is, or passing along and adding their own infrastructure fees. It is important to note that some communities double, triple, and even quadruple SAC fees based on their own add-ons. In general, one SAC unit is based on one single-family home equivalent. For businesses, a determination is done to determine the maximum potential wastewater capacity needed for that site. The determination is based on decades of engineering studies to determine the maximum flow from various types of businesses. The system is built to be fair and specific, so a laundromat pays more than a bookstore, for example. Most calculations are based on expected occupancy, meaning how many people will be in the building and for how long, although a few are based on fixture counts and some other criteria. The criteria are regularly reviewed with and improved with key stakeholder groups through our task forces. In terms of the financial picture, SAC pays about one-third of MCS's annual debt service. The remainder is paid with monthly wastewater fees. As you can see, debt service is MCS's largest budget component at 46% of our expenses. MCS's debt is 20-year fixed-rate bonds as well as PFA-subsidized loans. Between the Council's AAA bond rating and PFA assistance, MCS interest rates are very low, generally between 2 and 4%. In terms of revenue, SAC is a material source for MCS, accounting for about 15% of the total budget. Since debt service and most operating costs are relatively fixed, if SAC were eliminated, it would result in a 20% increase in the monthly flow charges paid by the cities and passed along to all ratepayers in their monthly bills. SAC allows MCAS to build pipes to meet future demand, but spread the cost over time and to charge the future consumers of future capacity. So in 1982, for example, a pipe was built to support growth through 2042. But through SAC, users in 1982 only paid for their portion of the pipe. Likewise, as growth occurred in 2012, those users paid for their portion. SAC distributes the cost of development across generations. Users are only charged when a new use increases the capacity demand. The current MCS system is built to meet the demand through 2040, when the estimated increase of 800,000 persons living in the region will need additional capacity for their homes and their jobs. SAC allows MCS to spread the cost into the future and essentially future-proofing the system for growth. SAC is a savings program promoting regional growth over time. Because of SAC, we have a system that can support growth in the region through 2040. Just recently, a metal refinisher located in the Twin Cities needed to upgrade its facilities to increase its efficiency and support its growth plan. It first tried to move to Wisconsin, but their permit was denied because the area could not support their wastewater flow or strength. They are now moving to New Hope, keeping 100 jobs in the region. Because of SAC, the region was ready to meet their capacity demand. This ability is not a given, especially for a large metro area. As recently as 2013, Miami-Dade faced a ban on all new development due to the full capacity in the system. They were then issued a multi-billion dollar consent decree that the ratepayers must now pay. In order to make sure SAC is meeting the development and business needs in the region, MCS regularly meets with stakeholders to consider changes and improvements to the system. SAC is supported by a 70-page manual that was written mostly by task forces throughout the years. For example, right now we're holding a task force, and the task force for 2016 and 17 is meant to represent diverse membership across the region. Representatives are geographically diverse from the core, inner ring, and outer ring, as well as functionally diverse with public works, building inspectors, finance directors, as well as small and medium business representatives.
Hey, Madam Chair, if I could, I'd like to jump in real quickly and point out that the chair of our task force that we currently have is here in the audience with us. It's our council member, Wendy Wolf, from Lakeville. She represents Council District 16 and is an expert on this issue as well. So if there's any questions, I'm sure she'd be happy to weigh in on that as well.
Very good. Welcome, Ms. Wolf.
For more context on the workings of SAC, SAC is determined by calculating the capacity demand for the busiest day of the year. Consider TCF Bank Stadium. Monthly average flow is quite low, since the stadium is only full a handful of days in a year. But SAC charges for the busiest day, like the Gophers-Badgers game, when MCS must have the capacity to handle the flow at halftime without a backup.
Mr. Smith, I'm going to pause you for a second. Representative Kosnick, a question?
Thank you. And Mr. Smith, we've got a couple new members came in here. Can you restate your example that you gave of that New Hope company? And then I have a follow-up question on that, or I guess I'll just ask it now. So are businesses given estimates of the SAC charges when they do a remodel or even as they expand or start a new business? And then if you could give that example that you mentioned so we can get some context. Thank you.
Businesses can certainly request an estimation, so that is a service that we offer. Typically, though, it's part of the permitting process. So the way that it works is a business comes to the city to get a building permit or a license to operate or something like that, and the city won't issue a permit until there is a determination issued by Metropolitan Council. So at that time, they apply to us, and we do the determination based on the plans, and I'll talk through in a minute how that's done. The specific example was a metal refinisher that was located in Minneapolis. They had some problems with the soil under their building, so it was condemned, and it was cost prohibitive for them to rebuild on that site. So they started looking for another site, and they went to Wisconsin thinking it would be cheaper over there for various reasons. And when they started working with the city council in the Wisconsin town, they found out that the sewage, the wastewater treatment facilities there wouldn't have capacity for their use. So then they came back here and found a site in New Hope where they could locate.
Any follow-up?
Just one. So when, at what point and how long does it take to get an estimate of if somebody was going to do that again or some business?
So, thank you, Madam Chair. So a determination takes, right now we're about a one-week turnaround. But if you ask your constituents, you will hear it's been longer. We've been at about up to 3 weeks over the past year, full disclosure. But we've had some we were short-staffed. We are now fully staffed. We have been for about 6 months. So we've been able to get that down. And so for the month of January, we were about 3 business days for a determination.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Smith, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Another example of maximum day capacity would be thinking about an Irish pub on a sunny 70-degree St. Patrick's Day that falls on a Saturday.
Is that happy hours, too?
I'm so glad you asked. So, again, your average flow may be relatively low for the system, for that restaurant, but on that given day, when they're absolutely packed indoors and out, then they have to be ready to serve on the busiest day, and again, without a backup. So we certainly see this at Irish bars. We see it at St. Paul locations on crushed ice. We see it on any lakeside restaurant on Lake Minnetonka or on the St. Croix River. Sunday afternoon, it's 70 degrees. It is full inside and out. So that's what SAC has to consider. I will share that we do have an outside discount. The outside SAC seating is discounted by 75%, and that's because when we need the capacity the most is when it's raining, because rain challenges our system. People don't sit outside when it rains, so there is some trade-off that outside seating, it is reasonable to give a discount. But in general, we have to think about if there's 40 seats indoors and 50 seats outdoors, we have to be ready for 90 seats. To serve that capacity. Now to get into some of the logistics of how it works. SAC is a one-time fee that is only charged when new capacity is demanded on the system. This could be a new construction, an addition, or when a remodel results in more usable space or a change of use creates higher demand, such as a bookstore converting to a restaurant. The square footage may be the same, but the resulting people and activity requires more capacity on the system. Through daily interactions with your community's staffs and end-user customers, the Council is very sensitive to the fact that SAC can be a significant charge for a developing business, especially when local communities can add anywhere from a one-time fee up to $7,500 per SAC on top of our charge of $2,485 per SAC. In addition to constantly working with our communities and customers to optimize the policies and trade-offs of the SAC system through our task forces, we also offer deferral programs to spread the cost of SAC for up to 10 years at our low AAA-rated debt rate with no penalties or fees. This way, businesses can spread the cost of SAC over time. So in conclusion, SAC is a great tool to help support regional growth and ensure generational equity in paying for the system, while helping to keep the region's monthly costs at some of the most competitive rates in the country. So thank you again for the opportunity to speak today, and I would be delighted to answer any questions.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's Mr. Smith, correct?
Yes, sir.
Appreciate your presentation today. Very informative. Learned something new with the deferral program, so plan to learn more about that. I want to pick up on a comment made by Representative Konzak with the three-day determination on the part of your staff to make the determination as to what the SAC charge will be. One of the complaints that I receive a lot of times is the delayed nature in which a business owner receives this cost estimate. Is there anything that can be done on the part of your agency to provide some level of insight? And I know you need technical drawings, you need all that information, which is kind of the end game on the part of the business that's moving into a space or building a new building. But is there something that can be done to provide some level of range or cost estimate to that business owner up front? Because the story I hear a lot of times is a business owner goes to the bank, they get a loan, it doesn't take into account the significant cost. Now they need to go back to their bank with their hat in their hand. They feel foolish because they didn't do their budgeting correctly because of this major fee. Now they're going back and asking for a larger loan. Just on how messy development can be sometimes, is there anything that can be done on the part of municipalities to help business owners that are coming in? And again, starting a business is like buying a house. You just don't do it every day. That can be shared in terms of, you get what I'm getting at, to what your agency could do to be more proactive so that those costs can be part of the business owner's budgeting process.
All right, Mr. Smith, we're all ears.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the question. That is something we are very sensitive to, and we hear it every day, too. So we call it internal. We call that the SAC surprise.
Yes.
And it's something that we are always trying to address. I'd say there's two primary things we're working on for that. The first would be more education. So part of my role is outreach to the community. So, in fact, I just spoke to a business community this morning at St. Paul. I'm talking to the Minnesota General Finance Officers Association in May. So anytime I can get out and talk to people, small business owners, small business associations, city staff, development staff, or building staff, we're always looking for those opportunities, and we are frequently out in the community sharing that. More specifically, though, we have just rolled out a tool on our website that you can use to estimate your SAC determination. It's based on square footage because most of our determinations are based on square footage. So you open up the tool, you tell it what kind of business you are. It's a drop-down box. So you say, I'm a restaurant, I'm a laundromat, I'm a whatever. And then you tell it how many square feet you have, and it will put out an estimate for what the SAC charge would be.
That's good news. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to make a couple of comments with regard to SAC and the relationship between environmental services and the Met Council's planning overall. Number one, I want to let you know that I have a strong disapproval of your granting waivers to SAC charges, particularly for subsidized housing projects and other types of housing endeavors. You're shifting that cost onto the private sector, not unlike anything we do in the property tax system. So I would ask you to take a look at that. Secondly, is really the manipulation of the growth patterns that really should be driven a little bit more by market resources or market forces, I meant to say. Particularly in parts of our region, we have discharge points around your area of jurisdiction. And obviously to build pipe and infrastructure from some of where it exists all the way out to the farther reaches of the region, of the county, particularly I represent Western Hennepin. So you have the ability to build smaller plants and not have to put such large pipe in the ground in terms of running everything to your current facilities or plants. And I know that the Met Council is certainly planning one up in the Dayton-Hanover area, somewhere in St. Michael, up in that region. But, Met Council's mission initially was to accommodate the plans of the communities rather than the communities responding to the plans of the Met Council. And so I don't think over the last 30 or 40 years, as that mission has become, instead of a wedding cake, it's now an upside-down wedding cake, kind of a top-down, heavy-handed, you comply with our vision of how the region is going to grow. And lastly, with regard to availability of sewer into areas, in the building industry, when things were humming along, the industry in the metro was building, you know, 20 to 25,000 units a year in terms of single-family residences as a region. And during the recession, that's collapsed. You know, we're probably at 5 or 6, maybe hovering in that region right now, so maybe 25 or 30%. But when things are normal, and we're slowly getting back to that, I don't think the council is respondent enough to keeping an ample supply of lots available for the industry. And the Met Council, in and of itself, by your restrictive land use policy and the unavailability of sewer to a region, has been one of the principal factors of driving up the cost of housing in our region in terms of no land in the metro region. It's a commodity. It becomes scarce. And I saw wholesale land prices in Second Suburban Ring from 2000 roughly to 2005 climb 500%. And when a lot typically might have sold in Brooklyn Park for $29,000 to $49,000, suddenly they're $120,000 to $150,000. And it's this type of not being ahead of the game, not proactively making sure that there's always a 2-year supply of lots available in the region, is problematic because you artificially drive up the price of housing, because the land component itself is 25 to 30% of the cost of a new home. So by having ample supply of land, you don't put pressures to drive the price of lots sky high. Now, we've had a correction because of the recession, and this is a time to make those investments and get a little bit ahead of the game and make sure that there's always enough land available to keep building new homes on affordable lots.
So, Mr. Smith, first of all, I'm not sure I heard a question, but perhaps, you know, if you want to comment, either of you, for that?
Madam Chair, and Representative Pertas, I appreciate your comments. I think between Mr. Smith and I, we would probably defer to one of the policymakers at the council to address some of your concerns. I think that would probably be the best way, because those are decisions that neither one of us are making. But we'd be happy to follow up with you or the committee or however you would like to do that to continue that conversation, because a lot of the work that we do is really required for us to do through statute, and it's the interpretation of that statute that's the council's work. And so
And Mr. Shetland, I think too, maybe it relates somewhat to Thrive 2040, so we'll be having those conversations for a while, I would think. But Mr. Smith?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do want to address the issue of waivers for SAC charges. Currently, there are no waivers for SAC charges, including affordable housing. So that was the result of a 2013 task force where we asked the committee, do you want to give waivers for affordable housing? And the answer was no. So that became the policy of Environmental Services, that there are no waivers. This issue came up again in 2015 as we were looking at manufactured homes and how do we help them with the burden of converting to the system. And we formed a task force in 2016. We're in the middle of that right now, but in December we discussed, we said there's a policy that we don't do waivers for affordable housing. Are we in agreement there should be a policy that we don't do waivers for manufactured housing as well? And the task force overwhelmingly agreed that, yes, we need to keep those waivers in place. So we are very adamant that SAC is, if you are a user of the system, you need to pay for it, and it's not up to Environmental Services to decide who's paying for somebody else's SAC. For us, it's if you use our system, you'll need to pay for it. So there are no SAC waivers.
Okay. So, Ms. Wolf, did you wish to comment also?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Wendy Wolf. On the availability of land, our current policy is for a 30-year rolling land supply, so communities kind of project into the future what land they're going to need in usually 5 or 10 year increments to come into the sewered area of the metro, and land development has actually fallen well behind what they anticipated it would be in our last round of comprehensive plan updates. So we're projecting that what was going to be our 2030 land supply is now our 2040 land supply. That's not that the council is saying that you need to limit your land. That's that there is already, according to cities, land available to accommodate that growth. We're not trying to say that you can't develop. That's what we've been asked to develop. And the pipe is actually in place out to 2040. All of our pipes are in place for our system through 2040 to accommodate all of that growth. So we're not anticipating sending big pipes out to anywhere in the metro where they aren't already in the ground, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you. And Representative Hornstein?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, as a fiscal conservative, I was waiting for more chuckles and smirks. No, seriously, there's something that's bothered me a little bit, and I wanted to see if this is still an issue over the years. I remember a few years ago at one of our Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Governance meetings, I think the mayor of Norwood Young America came and was upset because with the Met Council because they hadn't been expediting some kind of a interceptor project there. And then, of course, we had a lot of controversy about the situation in Elko and Newmarket many years back. And, you know, I look at these projects, these interceptor projects, they're not cheap. You know, the Elm Creek Interceptor. Are you still getting requests from some of these more far-flung areas of the region to build these, you know, interceptor projects that are, you know, quite expensive? And, you know, what's the status of that? And then I guess, is there a way for the public to kind of get a sense of what, you know, is there a website or some kind of way that people can see what are the pending kind of interceptor large investment capital projects that are kind of on the table that the Met Council is considering? I mean, I think we're talking about, like, projects that are $300 million and, you know, maybe don't even serve that many people. So is this kind of still an issue? I'm just, again, recalling past meetings where this topic has come up.
Mr. Smith?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So our system is now built through 2040. So we have no plans on any future interceptor projects through 2040. I definitely think the changes since the recession have dampened requests for additional growth. I can tell you in terms of is there visibility, we do have a capital program, so we spend about $100 to $130 million per year. 80% of that right now is for rehabilitation, so relining the pipes, fixing old pipes. 15% is for improving the system, improving the efficiency of the system, and then the remainder is for actual growth. But even that growth is mostly through growing the capacity of our plants. But we do have on our website, we have disclosures of all of our capital programs and where their location is. And we also, as a capital program comes into a community, we do extensive outreach to that community to help them understand the impacts of what's coming in their region.
Representative Hornstein.
So thank you very much. So this is interesting information. So we're built out in terms of sewer infrastructure. No plans at this point. We're done. In terms of new interceptors, new investments.
That's not what they're saying.
Mr. Smith.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, through 2040.
Right.
That's correct.
And then one last question, Madam Chair. So anything beyond 2040, that still has to be, you're starting from scratch in terms of a planning process, a citizen-involved process, whatever it takes. At this point, we won't be hearing much until maybe closer to 2040.
Mr. Smith.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Actually, that's a wonderful segue into our Thrive 2040 discussion a little later.
I don't mean that.
Because we, by statute, rebuild the plan every 10 years. So we're actually about to start that again to create what will be Thrive 2050. So that outreach will start to help us put together that plan. So there will be very soon ongoing outreach to figure out what does it look like beyond 2050. We are not done planning. Mm-hmm. We're just saying that the infrastructure we have now supports through 2040, and now the next step is to start planning through 2050. I hope I said that right.
Did you want to add to that, Ms. Wolf?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. The map that you had in your presentation 2 days ago had different colors. Like for Empire, it was a darker pink and then a lighter pink. The dark pink is what is served now. The light pink is what could be served using the existing pipes or the plants that are in place. And there's some discussion. There's plans long term for a future plant out, like was mentioned before. The land has already been acquired, and so we do very, very long-term planning. We plan the pipes 70 years out, and then the plants are 30-ish. So we have land in a couple of places for future plants.
All right. Representative Whalen. Question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for your presentation. All the information is very helpful. And forgive me if I missed this or if there was more to this, but on the last slide there is a mention of programs that help small and medium businesses defer the cost of SAC, which reminded me I had a conversation probably 2 years ago now, and there was a small business, which actually wasn't in my district, but it was a young woman, 21, entrepreneur. She opened a cupcake shop. Amazing. She had interned in Disney World. Her cupcakes were phenomenal. And I was just chatting with her about what it was like, especially as a young woman opening up a business like that. And she said, you know, one of the things that really frustrated her was the unexpected SAC charge. She faced $10,000. And it was, I was shocked. I didn't realize that, that these expenses occurred. And now, the way you explained it, I completely understand there's people who need that, the pipes taken care of and all of that. And so I'm just wondering for her, I would call her a small business, small, medium business. So what, a few questions with this. How long have these programs existed? How does one take advantage of them? And what is considered small or medium? And then it says also that they defer the cost. I mean, who are those costs deferred to? So then would the taxpayers be picking up those costs, et cetera? And I know at that time she had talked to, I believe it was a liaison or someone from the Met Council a couple times. And so if the program did exist then and she wasn't able to take advantage of it, is there better messaging now about this program and how people can take advantage of it? So I've given you a lot there, but just want to get some information. Thank you.
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. The program was started in 2010, so it is somewhat new. In terms of how you get in, you do work through your city. So as the system is designed right now, we have to have an agreement with the city that the city agrees to help us do the deferral. But it usually takes city council action, but in terms, then they just call us. And we have, the contracts are ready to go. They're already written, so it's pretty easy to implement. The other interesting part about that is, so it is deferred, in terms of how the deferral works, we're the bank. So no one else pays the fee other than the interest. But our interest is very low, 2 to 3%. So we are the bank, so we basically hold that debt. And as the person makes the payments, it replenishes our general reserve, our general fund. The other nice part about that is if, say, the business owns 10 SAC and they make it 2 years in and then they go out of business, the community doesn't have to pick up the other 8. What we'll do is just credit that location for how much has been paid and then the rest disappears. And actually with SAC, it's not really cash out of our pocket up front. It's the cash we use to build the pipes. So there really is no loss to us other than we haven't collected revenue for those pipes, but another user will come along and we will be able to collect that. The definition of what is small, right now it is up to 25 SAC units, which is actually that's quite large. See if I can do some math in my head. 25 SAC units would be 250 seats in a restaurant. So it's quite large, but again, that is also up to each city to decide what they want that cap to be, but they can cap it up to 25 units.
Okay. Any follow-up, Representative?
Yeah, just a real quick follow-up. So, and maybe we can, I actually would love to follow up with this young woman and get her some more information, but with the her specific location, the business had already existed. I think it was a shoe store before she took it over, so it was a there was a bathroom facility, and there was the different, I'm sure there was a sink, et cetera, but how is the specific, that $10,000 determined for her.
Mr. Smith.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. So that it was a shoe store, which may or may not have paid SAC. So that's one problem that we run into is whether there's good records or if the business has paid. Because if the prior business didn't have a permit or never went to the city, there might not be any SAC paid there. And then the question of, so if it was didn't change the bathroom, didn't change the sink, SAC, again, is determined by the number of people that are going to be in the business and what they're going to be doing there, not so much the number of fixtures. So a bathroom that serves a shoe store probably won't get used as much as a bathroom that serves a bar.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that the determination actually works is we get the plans from the business owner for here's the square footage, here's the actual architectural drawings, and we calculate what's the usable space for how many seats. So we calculate the square footage of the seating area and say, okay, so kitchen, actually, ironically, bathrooms are excluded from our calculation, mm-hmm. as are kitchens. We only look at, again, because we're concerned with who's there and how long are they going to be there. So we figure out how many people can you fit in that restaurant. And we do that based on the floor plans to tell us how many square feet of seating area. Then we make the criteria is 15 square feet per person. This is probably a little inside baseball, but just to walk you through one maybe would be helpful. So you figure out if it's, say, it was 150 square feet of seating area, and the criteria is 15 square feet per seat, which is per person. So we say 150 square feet divided by 15, so that's 10 seats. So I can fit 10 people in that restaurant, and then the criteria is 10 seats per SAC. So 150 square feet would generate one SAC. So that the calculation is done, we figure out what the total charge would be for that business, and then we look up the records to see what's been paid in the past. So we might, Representative Hertaus, you mentioned that someone went into a restaurant, all they did was remodel, they didn't change the floor plan, didn't change the seating, but they might have. They might have shifted a bar, they might have pulled out a pool table and put in more chairs. So it's the square footage of what's available for seating, and then we look at what's been paid in the past and then charge the difference.
Okay. So I just have a question, too, then, along that line. So those all sound like very busy kinds of businesses, but say it's an Edward Jones insurance little place, and there's two employees. That can't be very much, and certainly the uses for that building, haven't changed probably since whoever owned it before that or leased it, rather. So what's the situation in when that occurs? A new lessee, with virtually the same business and very, very few employees and unlikely to have much traffic.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the criteria for an office is much higher in square footage than it would be for a restaurant. So it's 150 square feet per sack for a restaurant. An office is closer to 2,000 square feet per sack. So the assumption is in an office you won't have as many people packed in. We even differentiate between a conference room versus office space to make up for that. So it's basically a 1,000 square foot restaurant versus a 1,000 square foot office, the difference would almost be a factor of more than 10.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's very helpful. All right. Seeing no other questions, just want to say thank you very much. It's helpful to really understand a lot more than we had before. I'm sorry, did we have another question? No. Did you have a question, Representative McDonald?
Madam Chair, thank you. Well, I did request a question. I had my name on the list a while ago, but that's all right. It was answered by your question, Madam Chair, your good wisdom and insight. But can I add to it quickly then?
Certainly. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you. Just curious, the SAC fees, in your material you say it's a one-time charge. And I'm familiar with SAC fees being a former mayor, so I understand that the fee is necessary to build the pipe and the infrastructure, but then also don't each business has a sewer fee that they pay for. So, A, do you know in the cities in your region, do they most likely have a sewer fee that they pay? And with that, do they have a, like the city of Delano has a sewer surcharge fee of some sort that goes into a capital improvements for future maintenance on pipes? I think it's $5.50 a month plus our sewer fee. So when I built my house, we paid a SAC fee, one-time fee, as it says in your material, but then each month a fee. So the cities that you service, do they have to, do they pay that fee? And then also, do they pass on the expense? Do they add to that expense in your SAC fee?
Mr. Smith.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. So the way I like to think about our system and our interceptor system is we're kind of like the interstate highways. And then there are local pipes that each city owns and maintains, and those are more like your county roads and your local streets. So those sewer fees are for the upkeep and maintenance of the city's infrastructure. So we do not see that's only we would up front we see the sewer availability charge of $24.85, but any fee that gets added on to that by the city is not passed on to us because it's not our infrastructure. That belongs to the city, and they need to maintain their capital program. The general rule of thumb is if you start in the core, so Minneapolis and St. Paul, who are very old and have most of their infrastructure built, generally do not add sewer availability charge, their own local SAC. We call it local SAC and local WAC. SAC is sewer availability charge, so that's the pipe that takes the wastewater out. There's also many cities charge a WAC, water access charge, and that's to get the pipe to your house. But again, the local SAC and local WAC is for their infrastructure. And as a general rule, and it varies by exact city, but it, the closer you are to the core, the less likely you are to encounter local SAC and local WAC. The further out you go, because those are newer communities, they're still building out their system, they will charge local SAC and local WAC that then stays within their general fund.
All right, Representative McDonald?
Madam Chair, so then a business could be hit up with a double SAC and WAC, and what is why we hear so much from small businesses in this in your seven-county metropolitan area that a $10,000 or SAC fee, correct?
Mr. Smith?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's precisely right. So when somebody calls me and says, oh, my gosh, Met Council charged me $100,000, my first question is, where do you live or where is your business? And then when we figure out where their business is, we dig in and we find out that $25,000 went to the Metropolitan Council and $50,000, even $75,000 went to the local community. What happens, though, is those local communities use our SAC determination. So we determine that there's four SAC due. And so from us, that's $10,000. But then the local communities add another $2,000, $3,000, up to $7,500 per SAC. So they use our number, but it comes up with their calculation.
Right.
Madam Chair?
All right. McDonald.
Just to follow up.
Okay.
Just to share Representative Hurtas's quick statement that you get whacked with a SAC. Double time, right?
Okay. Ms. Wolf?
Thank you, Madam Chair. One thing to remember is that our overall rates, we're a wholesaler, first of all, so cities have a little wiggle on what they do with our charge. But also remember that if we didn't charge SAC, that our wastewater rates would have to be 20% higher. So Mr. Smith did the math, and it's about, for a typical business, it's about a four-year payback on that SAC. You make it back in lower wastewater fees. So if we didn't charge SAC, most people would be paying significantly more on their monthly or quarterly wastewater bills.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Representative Kosnick.
Okay, thank you. And I know we want to get on to the next part of the testimony, but I think it'd be beneficial. Could you give us a little bit of the background on the history of the rates of SAC in the more recent, and I know there's been a little bit more discussion about that, and outdoor patios a little bit, and kind of succinctly, because we do want to get on with the rest of the agenda for today.
Mr. Smith?
Madam Chair, members of the committee. So SAC currently is $2,485 per unit. That has been fixed since January 1st of 2014. So we are at the fourth year in a row going into 2017 where SAC will be the same rate as the prior year. For perspective, if you went back to the beginning of the program in 1973, it was about $300 per unit. And it's been a pretty linear increase since then, generally $50 to $125. We faced a little rough spot in 2009, 2010, 2011, where our volumes were so low we had to increase it a little more. But that's kind of shooting yourself in the foot, because the harder you make development, the less it's going to happen. So we try very hard to keep those rates as low as we can. But it's based on we have a fixed amount of debt service that we have to pay. So we estimate how many SAC we think we will collect in the next year, divide that into the number, to the amount of debt service that SAC has to pay, and that's how we come up with our rate.
Okay.
And I,
all right.
I'm sorry, the other. Oh.
Madam Chair.
Oh, and restaurants. I'm sorry. So restaurants, that is an issue that started back in 2009. We used to charge outdoor seating the exact same amount as indoor seating. In 2009, we were asked to take a look at that. We hired some engineers and some consultants to do a thorough review. And this was where we discovered the trade-off between raining and outdoor seating. So we figured out that when it rains, it increases the demand on the system. So that is when our system is strained. And when it rains, excuse me, people are not outside. So there should be some acknowledgement that people only eat outside when our system is emptier. The original task force recommendation was to give a 50% discount. That went to the Metropolitan Council, and the council thought that it was in the best interest of development in the region to cut that another 25% to a 75% discount.
Okay, so a lot of interest generated here on this topic. Are we complete with our questions? Okay, very good. So appreciate very much your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam.
And we'll switch teams here. We're going to go to Metro Mobility.
Madam Chair.
Very good.
Great. Madam Chair,
Mr. Shannon.
I have Mr. Nick Thompson with me. We visited with Nick last week and we gave an overview of the council's role in transportation planning. He's also the director of the of MTS, which includes Metro Mobility, so he's here to provide that overview for the committee now.
Okay, very good. Mr. Shetland, welcome, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nick Thompson with Metropolitan Council. I thank you for the opportunity to talk and explain Metro Mobility today. It's a program that we get a lot of questions about, and has, again, a lot of detail that kind of drive how the program works, and so we thought we'd go in and describe the service today. What Metro Mobility is, it's a shared ride transit service, door-through-door service, we call it. That's where the driver helps the rider, picks them from door to door through the service. It's public transportation for people with a disability who are unable to use regular route transit service, at least at certain times, because of their disability. We determine the eligibility of the persons that can use the service. It's based on their condition, not on their ability to drive a car or not. We generally provide service in, we do shared ride where possible to make it more efficient, so it can have multiple riders on a Metro Mobility bus in the same direction of the trip, as long as we can meet our performance standards for those trips. And the ride on Metro Mobility is designed to be compatible with what a trip would be on a regular route transit. It is not trying to compare or provide a service equal to if you were to drive a car for the same trip. So we really, our performance is tied to what that similar trip would take on a transit, a fixed route transit service. It's important to understand the timeline of how this program has changed over time and some certain statutes that have really shaped how the program operates. It's a program that's been around a long time. This is an essential program for the riders of the system. This is their mode of transportation. They usually have no other option. So the program that's designed today started as far back as 1976 as a pilot in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and has grown. In 1979, it was reorganized under the Metro Mobility brand. And over time there's some changes, but really in 1990, that's when the federal requirements for the program with the passage of the Americans with Disability Act, and that really guides on some of the services and the requirements that we have on the program. So that was in 1990. But really, because of our early development of Metro Mobility in the region, when ADA law was passed, we had a service that was very compatible with the requirements of the ADA. It's a program that changes, as you'll see later, the cost of the program. It's an expensive program, so we're always trying to find ways to make it more efficient. We had tried to completely privatize the program in 1993. That had some challenges that led to even the National Guard being called up to be the drivers of the system due to problems with how that was implemented. Stepping back for that really caused a look about how the program was designed. We redesigned the system after that to kind of have a service center with multiple areas of delivery in the region. And that council took over the service after that in 1994. In 2006, we were facing some issues with budget and having continuous growth on the system, looking at possible fare increases. And so there was consideration for changing the service area for Metro Mobility in 2006. And at that time, state legislature took action and kind of froze the area that the services provided to match up with transit taxing district as it existed in 2006. And there'll be a map about that service coming up. As we were trying to get the system more efficient, really in 2015 we completely reshaped the service model and rebid in a competitive process and realigned the service so that there's three providers of the Metro Mobility in the general service, and that occurred in 2015 and has had some positive impacts and also resulted in some operational changes for the customer, to benefit the customer. So if you look at the service area, and we'll get into this, there's really two layers of service for Metro Mobility that guide how we can provide the service. There in the green, is, or in the center of it, is the areas where the ADA law applies to the Metro Mobility. So this is where the 1990 legislation and the requirements that came with it fixed that route, that geographic area, and that really, and I'll get into details, it's tied to the area that there are fixed route transit service. The blue area is what is the area of the transit taxing district in 2006. So that's the area where that was required to provide service after 2006. Now the transit taxing district since that time has changed. It's, for example, the city of Lakeville has been added to the transit taxing district, but the way the legislation was written, it's fixed at that taxing district that was in 2006. So as the taxing district changes, the service area of Metro Mobility is not changing. And then there's a small piece in the dark green where transit service, fixed route transit service, is expanded slightly beyond the transit taxing district, and we are effectively required to provide Metro Mobility in that service area, and that can change over time.
Are those like city boundaries, if I could ask about those? To conform with?
Madam Chair, it conforms with actually transit, fixed route transit, so within 3/4 of a mile of a route. So it does not necessarily follow city boundaries for the federally mandated.
And Madam Chair and members, just to add, in 2006 when this footprint was established by the legislature, it passed the House 131-0 and the Senate 64-0. It was carried by then Representative Mary Liz Holbergen in the Senate by Senator Steve Murphy, and it really was, we were looking at having to take major reductions to our transit system at that point to deal with the budget deficit we had at the time, and the intent was to make sure that those people who were currently using the Metro Mobility system were not going to lose that service if the footprint of our regular route system was reduced by the legislature. So it was kind of a backstop. And so since that point in time, that has remained the same. And as Nick just mentioned, those areas that you see the little green, they are because the fixed route has gone to that point, so they fall in the area that the feds require us to provide that service.
Great, thank you. Mm-hmm. Please proceed, Mr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So getting into, so if you think about it in two types of applicable laws that really guide the service and kind of set up how the service operates and kind of restrict how the service operates, that fixed federal area would be, the goal there is to provide a service that's comparable to regular route service that's provided in that area. Whereas when we say the Minnesota, the broader area passed by the 2006 statute, is really about access, providing access to a service for those that need a service like Metro Mobility. Federal guidelines are very specific about who can use the service. It is for those that are certified who are unable to use a regular route transit service. There is no similar certification for Minnesota statute area. But again, we're trying to operate a single system to the customer. As the map defined, it's really the service area is within 3/4 of a mile of the fixed route service. So if you're within 3/4 of any side, either side of a fixed route, Metro Mobility is a service that's available to you as the user. The service level, and this is an important part, it's curb-to-curb and door-to-door. It's the federal requirement. Our service is door-through-door. Our drivers get out of the bus, they go in, they help assist the customer to the bus, and then once they get to the destination, assist them through the door of the place they're going to go, if that is the service they would like. And most of the riders do have to require that service. As we set the hours, the hours for the federally required area match up with the service in that area provided by the fixed route. For the greater area, there's not a requirement, but we try it. If there's a fixed route, we tie to that. But if there's no service, we are generally from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. weekdays and 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. on weekends in that broader area. Capacity restrictions. This is a very important point. Within the federal area, whatever the demand is, we meet it. We are required to meet the demand. And so that's where you'll see later, as there's growth, we meet that growth. We're required to have no denials of service for anybody who needs this service and calls. In the greater area, we do not have this requirement, so there are times when service is denied in the greater area, but we try our best to provide every trip that is requested. Trips need to be planned in advance. This is not a service where you can call up today and get it in the next hour. We plan our trips in advance, and this is important for our routing of system to make it efficient. Generally, you can have up to 14 days in advance planned, but we have a 1 to 4 day kind of operation where customers call with 1 to 4 days from when they need a trip. They can also have a scheduled trip, a reoccurring trip, if they have, for instance, a job where they need to be there at the same time each day. That can be scheduled. We provide a guarantee of service that within 1 hour of either side of the requested time. So if you request that to be picked up at 9 a.m., our service allows that it can be picked up as early as 8 or as late as 10 and still be within the federal requirements. And in the fare structure, by law, in the federal area, you cannot exceed 2 times your base rate of the regular route. In our case, we are slightly below that. Our current is $3 for an off-peak trip or $4 for a peak trip on Metro Mobility. And the last thing is trip purpose. We do not discriminate based on trip purpose. If somebody requests a trip, we provide that trip no matter what the purpose of the trip, and we do not prioritize trips based on the purpose. So we are meeting the standards that are required. We are not allowed to prioritize trips by purpose.
Yes, Representative Bernardi.
Madam Chair, I didn't look ahead, so I'm not sure. Were you just wrapping up on this presentation? Do you have more to go?
Mm-hmm. We have a couple more.
A couple more? I can wait until they get to that. I have some detailed questions.
Okay, great.
Madam Chair, members, I thought if we talk a little bit about who the riders are, the users of this system, it's across all demographics. Those under the age of 65 are generally the heavier users, but a smaller set of the population. They're using it more frequently and for jobs, for work, and for everyday life. But we have the aging demographic for those that are unable to use fixed route, They are have a big share of the user base, but they use the route service less frequently. This is a service, as I said, that you meet the demand that is requested. And so it is a service that is growing on average about, the demand is about growing about 7% per year. We do not see a, any future in the near term where that growth is going to curtail. We expect with the demographics it's going to grow. And so we have costs. It's almost a one-to-one cost where you add a trip, you add a trip cost. So there's very limited options to become more efficient as you grow, and it's a one-to-one cost. Though over the past 2 years, we've implemented some major technology changes and rebid the contracts, and it looks like we've maybe in the short term stabilized the cost growth. When we look at fare box recovery, this is a heavily subsidized service that is cost roughly $26 to $27 per trip per rider. And as I mentioned, the fares are between $3 off off-peak and $4 peak. So our fare box recovery is very low, around 10%. But we are really measuring the service against what is required to provide for on-time and service delivery, and we are meeting those performance standards as required.
And, Madam Chair, I'll just jump in here. We'll be back in front of the Transportation Finance Committee to talk about the governor's budget. We spoke a little bit about this at the joint hearing we did a couple weeks ago, but as Mr. Thompson mentioned, this is required service, and when you look at the growth rate that we're seeing, or the anticipated growth rate that we're seeing of Metro Mobility and our aging population, the folks will be certified for Metro Mobility, we have to provide that service. And one of the things we talked about before is that we have a budget deficit that we're coming forward with the to the legislature with, and $24 million of that is due to growth above our current base of Metro Mobility ridership. And that is going to continue to grow. And right now from the state, we received just about $90 million of general fund. We're currently about $56 million of that per year funds Metro Mobility. By the year 2021, or the biennium after this, Metro Mobility costs are going to eat up that entire $90 million and actually cost more. And so we need to figure out a way to handle this, because it not only is it very expensive, but we have to provide it, which we would, but we need the state to partner with us to make sure that we have the ability to pay for those rides.
So just a question then, Mr. Shetland. I realize it's federally required, but, I mean, are you, as a business would, are you able to look at more efficiencies, I mean, ways to reduce costs, I mean, reduce, I don't know, excessive use? Can you look at any of the factors and work on trying to have a plan to reduce?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we do look at the efficiencies where we can, but we are required. We cannot deny a ride. That is the federal law within that area. So if a ride is requested, we need to meet that demand. So as the number of requests grows over time, we have to increase our service to meet that demand. We try to find efficiencies in terms of fleet and procurement, and that's why we did competitive bidding process and technology. And I'll talk a little bit, if we have time, about the technology that allows for a very efficient routing of software. But it's really that demand growth and the requirement that we meet demand that is requested that is driving the increase in cost.
Great. And, Madam Chair, just when you speak about efficiencies, that's one of the reasons when we are able to get to schedule the ride in advance, we're able to have, instead of just one rider in the van, we may be able to have two people that we're able to get to from one area to another area where they're both going at the same time. But the fact of the matter is we have no choice. We provide every ride. And so it is becoming very expensive for us to do that, and we are going to need the state's help in figuring out how to do this, because, again, as I mentioned, within the next 4 years, it will eat up our entire general fund appropriation.
Okay. Another question, Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It just occurred to me while you're talking about this and the service that's being provided, and is the Met Council prohibit tipping of these drivers?
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, members, I don't know if we have a policy for it. It does not occur. Tipping does not occur. They pay the fare. The riders pay the fare, that's what they pay.
But is
Ms. Hertas, Representative Hertas?
But is there a Met Council provision that prohibits tipping of the drivers?
Madam Chair, Representative Hertas, that's an interesting question I've never heard.
Right.
So why don't we find out, and we'll circle back with you and the committee on that. I just don't know. But either way, when that rider requests a ride, we provide it, whether or not they're going to provide a tip or not. Whatever we do, whenever the call comes, we provide it.
Okay. Now, Representative Mason?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other day I'd asked a question about, it's basically, if you look at the ADA, it's curb-to-curb and door-to-door upon individual request. But there is a Minnesota statute that said it has to do door-through-door. And the individual I was talking to was really upset because he goes into secure areas and having the driver with him creates problems.
Mr. Thompson, and I think I may have talked to the same individual there, Representative Mason.
Madam Chair, members, the point in question is that we call it escorting the rider through the service, and riders can request that they not be escorted. Of the, I think, 40,000 registered riders, we have six in the system that have requested to not have escorts. The information is provided to the drivers. Drivers are trained that if no escort is requested, they are not to provide an escorted service. But six out of 40,000, we drive into the for everybody else, we say you must escort over and over again. And we do have a problem that with the driver turnover, that occasionally some drivers continue to try to escort because they do that for almost everybody. And these few exceptions, for that particular individual who I've talked to also, on some occasions they've escorted even though he said he does not want an escort. Mm-hmm. And so we do recognize that.
Thank you.
Okay. Please proceed, Mr. Thompson. Did you want to have a question, Representative Bernardi?
I can wait, and then they're answering some of them, so I'll just wait till the end.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A little by the numbers, in 2016, our numbers are looking at, this is unaudited again, preliminary, but about $56.5 million was spent on this service. Well over 2 million rides in that time frame. A very safe system, very few incidents, but a lot of rides, roughly 7,000 to 8,000 rides per day. We have a database of 40,000 registered riders that can use this service. Many of these registered use it infrequently, and some are, all dynamic. Some use it almost every day. 530 vehicles. The Met Council procures the vehicles, owns the vehicles. The vehicles are used by the service providers that we contract with. These vehicles are purchased with RTC funding. The service crosses 93 of the communities in the metro area and is through four different competitively bid contracts.
And, Madam Chair, just to speak a little bit about RTC, that is a regional transit capital bonds. We come to the legislature. Most of the time we're in the public finance article of the tax bill. We've also done it in the transportation bill in the past. But what that is that's a property tax authorization that the legislature gives the council that we levy in the communities that have transit provided, and that allows us to replace our fleet for our Metro Transit system. It replaces our fleet for Metro Mobility, and it also replaces the fleet for the suburban transit provider providers as well. So in Representative Mason's district, that would be Minnesota Valley Transit. And so just so folks understand what RTC is, it is something that we rely on and need, and we're back at the legislature this year asking for that authorization as well. But just a little bit more detail for you.
Very good. Mr. Thompson, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it's important. This is a service that we contract out, but we have a primary responsibility for monitoring and oversight of this system. The system requires very good real-time data because we are required to meet these thresholds of having the trips arrive within that one-hour window. We have very specific requirements on on-time performance for trips. And so we have very sophisticated information. We can tell at any time what our on-time performance is in real time. This requires that all the fleet be outfitted with GPS for tracking and for dynamic routing of service. And also we have four cameras installed with recording equipment on all the fleet that we have access to the video so that we ensure that the service is high quality. And also if we have any complaints that we can go back in time and see what happened and document those issues. And And finally, we contract out the service to multiple vendors. We could have up to four different vendors out there, but we want to make sure there's a similar system to the customer. So we own the equipment, we buy the fleet, we procure the fleet, phone system, we monitor phones and for quality. That also allows us to be more efficient. We can use our buying power to get really effective pricing. So what is the customer experience for this? Right now, the customer, if they need a trip, just in general, they make the primary thing is they give a call to the dispatch center and request the trip. Call taker takes that information about where their origin is, what their destination is. Most of these customers have their information on file. Customers have very specific requirements based on their disability. That information is put into the system. And so we determine the route. That builds into the routing for the next day. The day of service, the routing information is downloaded so that we have optimized the network and delivery of services to meet the customer's needs for what time they want to be picked up or when their appointment is, and also the most effective routing and shared rides where possible. It's a phone-based system right now. We expect in the very near term that the customers will be able to use their smartphones to request a trip, see in real time where their trip is, when it's going to arrive, and that will help with some of our efficiency, too, and also just our customer service. So that is coming soon. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think we have questions. I don't know if you're...
One more slide.
Okay.
And talk about the challenges.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is a program that is essential to the riders, but it faces several challenges. We've already talked about the rising costs of it, the rising demand, and that we must meet that demand. We're also facing a pretty challenging environment to hire drivers. Driver-based system, we need drivers to meet that demand. Drivers need to provide that service. We are having a hard time hiring and retaining drivers. We pay $14 an hour as a starting wage. Right now, we are not necessarily competitive with similar services. And this is not an easy job for a driver. This is a physically demanding job. And so that's a big challenge we face now is how do we meet that required demand, attract drivers, and so we're looking at potentially things that could also increase costs, like increasing starting wage for drivers. When we reorganized in 2015, we eliminated the requirement to transfer at the boundaries of the service area. This is a very good thing for the customer. They can make a single trip. They didn't have to transfer vehicles. But it has resulted in slightly increased trip length. The length of the trip increases your cost because of the amount of time the driver is with that individual rider. On average, our trips are about 10 miles long on average across the system. We do see some new federal requirements that are increasing, putting cost pressures on. A lot of these are around service performance. For instance, the minimum wait time a rider can, when they call for service, minimum time they can be on hold before their trip is taken care of. So that's, and then closely monitoring our on-time performance and really making sure in the oversight role that we're meeting the requirements of the ADA law. So these are the challenges the program faces in delivering the service, but is a key service to the users. This is their only, for many of them, it's their only form of transportation and enables them to get to work, to education, to where they need to go. That's an essential service to the customers. And with that, I will close and then take any questions.
Okay, very good. So a question from Representative Bernardi.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple questions here and just one comment. I know somebody who does drive for Metro Mobility, and they might be under a contractor, and I just know I heard one time how much they made, and it wasn't very much money, so I knew that, but their health benefits were like, I think they were like $800 a month for their family. I mean, it was really expensive, so I don't know if that's accurate, but I know it was a huge impact to this family.
Madam Chair, Representative, all the drivers of Metro Mobility are through the private operator of the service, and it is a challenging job, and as I mentioned, their starting wage is around $14, and the benefit package is up to the private provider. So I'm not exactly familiar with the details, but they are in a competitive environment for drivers and other transportation systems that are paying much higher starting wages now, so it is a challenging environment.
Okay, so thank you, Madam Chair. That wasn't actually. I mean, you answered my question, but I was just making a comment, and that was like 5 years ago when I heard this number. But what I wanted to ask, the RTC, you had mentioned it's within the communities, or the bonding is done within the transit taxing
district. Madam Chair, it's in the regional transit capital levy area. It's also formerly known as the transit taxing district.
Right. And Madam Chair, I just want to comment that there is issues with that, because people who drive in to park and ride, I know you did some different things with Lakeville, but people come from outside the taxing district and use the buses and aren't being taxed for that. I think that's something we need to look into. And then secondly, Madam Chair, would you comment on that, is that too political?
Mr. Shetland, would you like a question instead?
Well, I always respond to questions. So the Madam Chair and Representative Bernardi, back in 2001, when the transit system moved off of the property tax and then went on to the general fund and the motor vehicle sales tax, we had a there was a taxing area at that point where folks who lived within that area paid 90% of the cost of the transit system, and then outside that area, which was more exurban area, they paid a 10% property tax to pay for some of the capital costs that went along with the transit link, the dial ride service, which is the transit service that we provide outside of the regular transit area. When that conversion was made off of property tax, that 10% was lifted. And so I'm going to give you more factual information than what the legislature chooses to do about whether or not they want to address that or not. But that area previously paid into the transit capital levy area, but that went away when we moved the transit system off of the property tax.
Right. Okay. Any follow-up, Representative?
But Madam Chair, and one more thing, Representative Bernardi, there was a lot of consternation over who was using the park and rides and where people were coming from, and there was some analysis that was done about motor vehicle sales tax is collected statewide. The general fund is provided from statewide funds, so everybody is paying a bit. Some are just paying a little bit more by not being levied for the transit capital levy. If that makes sense.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see that as
Senator Bernardi.
I see that core area subsidizing the other area since we picked up that cost. The other question I have is, have you talked yet? I didn't catch about how to get certified. You need certification, and I know people who have totally paralyzed from the waist down, and how would a person like that qualify, and how would they get the certification? And the other thing is, if someone doesn't live within the area, within the 3/4 mile area of a fixed route, then would they go to like dial a ride, or what's the option for them in the metropolitan area?
Madam Chair, Representative, the first question, we Met Council is responsible for the certification process, and so we have an individual certification of passengers or potential customers, and once certified, depending on their most of them are certified permanently in the system. They only have to do that once. And so that's a process, actually, that we went to in 2005, where we had to certify all riders. Prior to that, it was kind of a self-certified system by the passenger. And so we made that switch, and that's our responsibility. And in some cases, doctors are involved, and they have to fill out forms and such to verify certification. But that is done typically at the Met Council, at the office, at Metro Mobility Office. Second question.
Okay.
Oh, the second question was outside of the fixed route is the broader area. As long as you're within that area defined in 2006, that's where you can get Metro Mobility service. It just has slightly different requirements because it's a state law for that area. The federal requirements kind of overlay the area tied to the fixed route scheduled area, and the broader area is tied to the state law from 2006 of the transit taxing district boundaries at that time. Boundaries are different today, but that service is fixed. So if they live within that area, then they can receive service.
Okay, so Madam Chair, thank you, Madam Chair. So I represent Anoka County, and although my constituents aren't in the northern part of the county, would those that aren't part of that boundary, do they use Dial-A-Ride then?
Mr. Thompson?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, Dial-A-Ride would be available to them if that's a service that, depending on what their disability is, that would work for them.
Okay, and then, Madam Chair, one last thing. I'm interested in the details of how certification and how people are informed to get certified, because the person that I happen to know who's paralyzed, they've wanted to figure out how to do this, and they've been paralyzed for like 5 or 6 years, and they really do need a program like this, and how accessible it is to people to find out, and I just want to know the details on who qualifies.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'd be happy to follow you up with the real details on how that process that they can go through and how to get that certification.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and you did answer half my question, and which was the average trip length was 10 miles. But on the curiosity on the extreme, what's the longest trip that you guys have scheduled?
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know offhand, but there are kind of the long tail. There are some long trips that occur 50 miles. I've seen some, but very few. The bulk of them are within that 10 or less. So,
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regarding non-emergency medical transportation, I don't believe that you service in that department. Is that correct?
Mr. Shetland.
Madam Chair, Representative, we do not. We provide specifically what is required under the Americans with Disabilities Act. So it is they wouldn't be eligible if it wasn't if they weren't certified with a disability for the for our service.
Representative McDonald.
And then lastly, would you like us to maybe contact our congressman and have the federal government get out of the business of mandating that customer wait times and other customer service issues and lead that to the state of Minnesota and to your expertise handle that department?
Mr. Shetland.
Madam Chair and Representative, again, I'm going to play this card. I'm not a policymaker, and so I am not that may be a better question for one of the council members or the council chair, but I understand your point. Fact is that we have to provide this, and what I want to leave the committee with, and I want to leave the Transportation Finance Committee with, is understanding that we want to provide this service. Oftentimes, this is the only mobility that some of these folks have, and so it is imperative that we provide a service for these folks, and we are proud and happy to do it, but it comes at a cost, and we need our funding partners to be aware of the pressures that we are now experiencing because of this, and we fund it out of the funds that we receive from the state that are commingled with how we operate our regular out bus system and our light rail lines. And so when we come forward with a budget, this has to be looked at commingled, where if you look at it in greater Minnesota, this is funded through the Department of Human Services, and the transit service in greater Minnesota is provided through MnDOT. In the metro area, they're all funded together. And so it's just something I want to make sure that the the leaders, the legislators, the committee members who are responsible for working with us in order to bring forward these types of services, that you're able to see in whole picture how the budgets all work together. And we have major pressures that are being put on us due to metro mobility, due to MVEST, due to the population growth that's coming to the city. So while I'm not going to answer the question that you asked me, I appreciate you listening to me tell you all the reasons why I'm happy that you're paying attention to this.
Madam Chair, I just want to make perfectly clear, I meant what the other testifier, don't recall the name, mentioned about federal requirements putting mandates on that make it more costly. This is a wonderful program. Of course, they don't come out to Wright County. I'm right on the border, Hennepin Wright, and we've had that discussion. But a wonderful program. Continue to support it financially and physically and otherwise. But I was just making light of the federal requirements of wait times. I think the state of Minnesota and the Metro Mobility have more expertise on what wait times are more important than the federal government mandating that. we know best how to do that and how to service our people and make sure good customer service is done than the federal government. That was the only point I wanted to make.
And Madam Chair, Representative, I understood that completely. So thank you. Okay.
All right, Representative Koznick.
Thank you, and Mr. Shetton and Mr. Thompson. I just wanted to clarify a couple things just from my notes here, trying to follow along and scribble as fast as I can. But can you just kind of clarify what the weekend service times are?
Mr. Thompson.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. So with the area where there is fixed route service, it matches the service times of that fixed route in that area. But if there's no fixed route, it's generally, just let me make sure I get it right for you. It's 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. on the weekends for that kind of that broad area where there's no fixed route service.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, I just had a couple other quick ones. If you don't mind.
No, go ahead, Representative.
We were talking about the escalating demand, and you were talking about the one-to-one cost and demand on that. Can you just briefly, and maybe it's not so brief, but what other innovative ideas or how are you attacking this? You'd mentioned technology and redoing some of the contracts. Is there anything else on the horizon that we can partner with you with?
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, Representative, so the two major ones that I mentioned, number one in 2014, the technology that kind of almost went from a paper routing system to a dynamically driven, that drove in some efficiencies in routing, no doubt. And then the competitive process, we had five service areas. We went to three. That, I think, definitely resulted in better rates in the competitive process. So those are two things recently. We could see with the mobile app, being that could be as an opportunity for efficiency of service with the customers. There's options with fleet and how we did that, but we think we've at least currently taken all the low-hanging fruit that we've had. And as you just add people and you still need to deliver that ride within 1 hour of the time, that really limits your ability to make more riders per trip and stuff. So, but we are always open and asking for ideas to drive this efficiency and provide a better service at a lower cost.
Excellent. And just one more follow-up. And then just, you mentioned four other vendors,
yes.
Mr. Thompson, previously in one of your responses, four other vendors. Is that other driver vendors, or I didn't quite follow it on your previous testimony?
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, could you repeat the question? I missed the first part of the question.
Madam Chair? In your previous testimony, you were talking about four other vendors and when you were redoing contracts, and can you just clarify that for me so I understand what are you vendors that are providing drivers or
Mr. Thompson.
Or what?
Madam Chair, Representative. So the services we provide is the drivers are not employees of the Met Council.
Okay.
They are employees of the vendors that bid on the service, and they bid per area. So you could have a provider, up to three different areas, so three different providers could be. And these are firms that are national firms that provide similar service around the country. So they have efficient systems, and then they're working in the market to attract drivers to meet the performance requirements that are in their contracts.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Bernardi.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure that we have this very clear and understanding. You know, it's kind of like a cross-subsidy kind of thing because it's a mandate. We right now spend, is it $56 million, about $56.5 million on the program. We get a general fund appropriation of $90 million. What? For all kinds of things. So what I'm trying to get down is I want us as legislators to understand how much we're putting towards the regular bus service so that when we see increases in funding or whatever, that we're not really decreasing our regular bus service. We need to make it more robust. We have 80% of the bus rides are for people who go to school or for our workers. So is there... Do you have any recommendations on how we can separate this so we have a great understanding of it? Because we're sitting listening to you, but a lot of our colleagues They're just going to see a number.
Right.
So could you help me out with that?
Mr. Shannon.
Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi, I can help you out with that. It is something that we will be discussing in the Transportation Finance Committee. We updated our budget page recently just for this governor's biennial budget. And how we break it out is we get motor vehicle sales tax, which is the major driver of our revenues for the transit system. And then we also receive money through fares. And we receive about $90 million per year from the general fund. And how we use the general fund dollars, we look at it in three tiers. Well, the first tier is to operate light rail. There is a state statute that requires us to do that. Chapter 473, 4051, subdivision 2, I think, Ms. Dyson, can help me with that. But that requires that off the top, the state has to pay 50% after you take off fares, and we split that with CTIB. The next piece comes down to metro mobility. Since it is a federal and a state mandate, we have to provide that service as well. The third tier, then, is our bus system. And what happens is since LRT comes off the top, we figure out what Metro Mobility is going to use. And right now it's $56.6 million. If you look at it over the next few years, that's going to grow. I think I mentioned earlier, it's going to grow to over our general fund base of $90 million within the next biennial budget that we negotiate. And so what happens is that if we're not able to find a way to fund that gap, it falls to bus. And bus will be operating just fine. But the fact is, you look at it on a triage, and we have to fund the 50% for the light rail. We have to fund the federally mandated and state mandated metro mobility. That if all things are square, we have to reduce regular out bus to make up, to make sure that we have a balanced budget. And bus is doing nothing wrong other than the fact that it isn't mandated. And that creates big problems for us to be able to provide a reliable transit system. And what it also means is that we're not building a system that is able to meet the demand. And we actually believe, and that's where we'll talk about this, Madam Chair, and the Transportation Finance Committee, but we have a plan to erase that and fund it with a stable, reliable funding source. And so it is... it's complicated, and I appreciate us talking about this in the policy committee. I realize it isn't where it probably belongs, but it is very important for us to understand this. And I'll be happy to make sure that everybody gets a copy of our budget that we submitted, because it lays it out there perfectly. I actually have copies here if anybody wants one.
And Representative Bernardi, are you wanting to know about the budget? Or?
No, but a follow-up. And okay. It has to do. No, I just want to say, when you talked about that scenario, you know, you say it's not necessarily this committee because we're not the finance committee, but there's policies Absolutely. In place for the other two tiers that those policies are affecting us. So I do believe it's part of this, because who knows, maybe we have a policy, too, regarding that becomes a mandate. I'm just throwing out how I think it is related to this committee. And I want to reiterate, in addition to the problem that it creates, the Met Council providing the great service and for people who use buses to go to work, school, whatever their mode of transportation they choose, that it's really a problem for my constituents and the people of Minnesota, because they're the ones that are getting the effects of not getting the kind of service that they need and our businesses need to have mobility in Minnesota now and for be competitive in the future. So I just wanted to bring people into the equation. Thank you.
All right. Representative Mason, and then we have one more, and it looks like we're going to run out of time. So
thank you, Madam Chair. In my community, I have a woman. This goes back to the mandated comment before. I have a woman who has a back problem. So because of the long waiting times, she really cannot take advantage of using Metro Mobility. But according to what I'm understanding, if she's not willing to do that hour wait, there's no option for her for you to help her. Is that right?
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, Representative, just to clarify, there isn't necessarily an hour wait. The service is that we must, we must provide the service within 1 hour of the requested time. And we try to match that up, and we give a 10-minute. When the driver is within 10 minutes of the pickup of the rider, they'll get an alert. So hopefully maybe there's a way that they can, as they're waiting for their ride, just that 10-minute warning maybe is helpful. But so the rides themselves can be long. If it's a longer route, you know, it's matching up with what the ride time would be for a regular route transit, not a personal vehicle. So the ride times can be long. So if it's inability to maybe sit for a long time and ride, that can be an issue that could arise.
Thank you. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, just to kind of clarify, because what I think I'm hearing is a little bit frustrating, or, you know, in terms of a policy and financial implications. But if I understood you right, if you could clarify, first you figure out how much money we need for light rail and use that money, subtract that away from funds available, and then you estimate how much money is available for Metro Mobility, and whatever's left over goes to buses. Is that true?
Madam Chair, that's absolutely correct. We have to follow state law, and state law requires that the 50% of the operating costs after fares comes from the state, and then we have no choice but to provide that service, not only in the ADA-certified area, but also the state-mandated service area for Metro Mobility, and then it falls to bus.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I don't want to complicate this. We also receive motor vehicle sales tax. But it is how all the funds come together, since it is a state mandate. The general fund is how we use it. That's how medical assistance is funded. And so it's a comparative, I guess, example.
Follow up?
No, and just maybe just a little bit of a statement, which I generally kind of shy away from, but I think I may speak for some of the members that I've talked with, but not being huge light rail advocates, because we don't believe in the capital costs and the exorbitant subsidy to operate it, that bus lines, either Metro Mobility and regular route services, bus rapid transit, that those are being sacrificed at the expense of light rail. And I guess I'll just continue that discussion in finance, but I guess I'd just like to express my frustration in that, and I hope that maybe we can have some ideas to make that more equitable between the three sources.
And Madam Chair and Representative Kosnick, just to respond, the light rail lines, the blue line, the green line, are our most efficient lines we have in our entire system. They are by far have the lowest per passenger subsidy of any service that we have in our system. And it is, but it doesn't work for everyone, and I recognize that. And that's why when we plan for service, when we're going to be before the Transportation Finance Committee, we're going to be talking about any expansion that we'd see with the governor's plan would primarily go into the bus system. And so that is a you raised your points. I just wanted to make sure that the committee understands that the per passenger subsidy on light rail is by far the lowest that we have in any mode in the system.
Representative Kosi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Shetland, I guess when we take it over in the finance side, if you could also have the per passenger per mile numbers available to us so we can discuss that as opposed to just the per passenger, because I think that makes a little bit of a difference as well. So we look forward to that discussion. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yep. And Madam Chair, I'll also include the state share in the capital cost of that as well.
Representative Hornstein.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and I wasn't planning to weigh in on this, but if we're going to have this discussion in finance, then we should look at the per passenger subsidy on the opt-out system as well.
All right. I think there's five more minutes. If we have any more questions from anybody. Okay, Representative Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was kind of weaves right into my point, the per passenger subsidy. When you said that the green line and what was the other one?
The blue line, the Hiawatha line.
Those two lines are the least subsidized lines of anything in light rail. That really doesn't address whether it could be a 50% subsidy and still be the least subsidized line in the industry. So that's where I was going. How much per passenger per mile is, and I would like to, you know, see a little bit of that.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Farr, and I think that gets to Representative Kosnick's point as well, and we'll be happy to provide that Back in 2011, the legislative auditor put together a audit of the transit system, transit governance, looked at all of the different modes of transit in the metro area. And so there was a table in there that broke it down by the express service, regular route service, the provider, the mode. It has a great table that I think we're going to update that, and we're going to share that with the committee, because that really does explain that transit just isn't one big T. There are a number of different ways to look at it, and breaks it down a number of different ways. So I appreciate the question. I appreciate actually Representative Kosnick's comments as well, and I think in the Transportation Policy Committee is probably a great place to have that conversation. So thank you very much for that to both of you.
Okay. We've covered these subjects, huh? Pretty well. So thanks so much for your presentations, Mr. Thompson, Mr. Shetnan.
Great. Thank you, and, Madam Chair. We'll miss
you.
Not being here.
It won't be long.
Oh,
certainly. So,
okay.
All right. The meeting is adjourned.